I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, it's LGBT Pride Month, that designation made by the White House for the third year in a row. We've been observing the month with conversations that explore issues of particular interest to the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community. Today, we're going to talk about a new report on the health challenges of the LGBT community and new information about how we know just how many LGBT people there really are. That conversation in a few minutes. But first, another conversation about the economy. So much of the conversation in Washington these days is about cutting government spending, not if, but how much. But a new group says the solution to the budget deficit is to raise taxes. And no, we're not talking about so-called tax and spend liberals. This comes from a group of very wealthy Americans. 200 of them, who call themselves the Patriotic Millionaires for Fiscal Strength, have signed a letter to President Obama and Congress asking them to raise their taxes and the taxes of the 375,000 other Americans who earn more than $1 million a year. Let's listen to a clip from a video the Patriotic Millionaires released yesterday.
We shouldn't be wallowing in our riches while everybody else is suffering.
10 years ago, you gave me a tax cut I didn't want and I didn't need.
Fix the mistake you made.
Because it is the right thing to do.
Tax me.
Tax me.
Tax me.
Tax me.
Tax me.
Tax me because my country, our country, means more than my money.
We wanted to talk more about this, so we've called on entrepreneur Dennis Meehl. He is chairman of U.S. Corrugated. They make cardboard boxes, and they operate plants in 15 states, among other businesses that he runs and owns. And he's with us now from NPR New York. Welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us.
Michelle, it's nice to be here.
We also wanted the perspective of a small business owner, so we've called upon Andy Shalal. Now, we've called upon him from time to time for comment about the economy and how things are going. He owns the restaurants Busboys and Poets and Eatonville in the Washington, D.C. area, and he's with us once again in our studios in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
So, Dennis Meehl, I'm going to start with you. As you know probably better than anybody, kind of the narrative around the economy these days is cutting spending, not raising taxes, and Republicans have said that that's a core issue for them in these negotiations, that they are not in favor of raising taxes at all. Why do you feel that it's important to raise taxes right now and on you?
Well, because you got to go where the money is. the reason we need to increase the marginal tax rate, in my view, on high earners is because it's absolutely essential that it's part of bringing some balance to our fiscal policies in this country. And if people say that the only approach is to reduce expenditures as we look out into the future, then what they're really saying is that the sacrifices that need to be made to move toward more balance in our fiscal policies, that those sacrifices have to be made by the people who essentially have the least.
Well, part of the timing around this effort by you and your other wealthy individuals is that 10 years ago, President Bush signed a law that heavily cut taxes. And the argument is that cutting taxes actually enhances economic growth by creating more jobs, giving people more money to spend and invest. And so I wanted to ask, did you personally benefit from the Bush tax cuts, and what did you do with the money?
Well, the answer to the first half of the question, I did benefit. My marginal tax rate is lower. It saves me $200,000 to $300,000 a year that I might otherwise have paid. It's a spurious argument that maintaining historically low marginal rates on very high earners, that somehow if they had to pay an extra 3 or 4%, which would be from $30,000 a year up to some multiple of that, depending on how much they own, that we're going to have less jobs. It's wrong, and history disproves it.
Andy Shalal, what's your perspective on this? And one of the reasons that I wanted to get your perspective on this is that the argument is that small businesses are particularly affected by the growth in government spending because it reduces the amount of capital available to them. So tell me, what's your perspective on this?
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is that most of the small businesses that we're talking about would not be affected by this proposed sort of pullback in the Bush-era tax cut. But the other part is that for me, as a subchapter S business, I have an incentive to spend more money before the end of the year, so I don't claim it as income. So for me, I spend it on infrastructure, I spend it on equipment, I spend it on refurbishing the places and so on. So that is an incentive. I could never understand the other argument of, you're going to have more money, it's going to be taxed. Well, spend it.
I would ask Andy a question.
Sure.
Okay. Because what's put forward by the other side in this debate is that a so-called small business person, whatever that means, if you were going to earn $1 million for the year, for example, then on the arithmetic, you might experience $20,000 or $30,000 more in taxes through your subchapter S than otherwise might have been the case if you made $1 million. Now, the argument is because you paid $20,000 or $25,000 more in taxes and you had an opportunity to open a restaurant around the corner that was going to be successful, that having made $25,000 less than $1 million, that you would not open that restaurant. I mean, I think it's preposterous on its face.
Well, I would agree with you.
Yeah, so it really doesn't hold water. And what it suggests is that regardless of the talking points and staying on message and all that, that the motives are different.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're speaking to Dennis Meehl. He is one of the 200 millionaires who have signed a letter asking the government to raise their taxes. We're also talking with Andy Shalal. He's owner of Busboys and Poets here in Washington, D.C. We called him for a small business owner's perspective.
Mr. Meehl, one of the things I was curious about is that when the prospect of raising taxes is offered up, there are two issues here. One is the economic theory at work. That's what House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan says, that his issue is it's not politics, it's economic theory. He really believes that keeping taxes as low as possible is the thing that stimulates growth in the economy. But the other argument is political, and that the argument is that this is class warfare, that when you talk about raising taxes, really what you're pitting, you know, the wealthy and successful against the less successful. So I'm curious, though, why you think your argument doesn't seem to have greater resonance to this point, particularly given that the number of people who are making this kind of money are a minority in the population. So why do you think that is?
Well, to begin with, I think we can rationally conclude that those people who are making the most money, and we've got people making up to a bill. I mean, I'm a piker next to a lot of the guys on that letter, okay, have the resources and the access to policymakers, to elected officials, and so on, that enable them to amplify their point of view in a way that the average person can't. When people talk about class warfare, I struggle with that a little bit. I think we have increasing income diversity in the country. Disparity, I think, is the word I was looking for. And as that grows, and it has grown substantially over the last 30 or 40 years, it puts the whole social contract under pressure and can lead to conditions and attitudes that we would not recognize as part of the value system that we have in this country. But we're not trying to create class warfare by pitting one group against another. We're saying that everybody needs to contribute to putting our fiscal house back in order. And I'll just say, not to be overly partisan, but the Republicans and Mr. Ryan say that it's absolutely wrong to ask anybody, irrespective of how great their resources are, to chip in what everyone agrees is a very, very significant challenge for our country, makes no sense to me. So I think they are pitting the classes against each other by framing the debate on that basis. I reject that argument.
And the statistics have sort of borne out. I mean, since 1979, the income disparity has gotten much, much wider. The top 1% of earners since 1979 have seen an increase of 280% in their income. The lower 2% of earners have seen an increase of 16%. The disparity is becoming wider and wider. I want to see more customers out there with money to come spend in my business. I don't want to see that as we're talking about the possibility of having the haves and have-nots and having this big disparity in our classes here in this country.
Andy, before we let you go, I wanted to ask just final thought. As we are talking, they're still sort of talking about a plan to reduce the budget deficit. From your perspective as a small business owner, what would you like these people to keep in mind, these lawmakers to keep in mind as they're having these discussions? What do you think is the key fact for you?
You know, we tend to think in this country that the idea of leveling the playing field is the way that you have fairness. But the reality is that people with money have a head start. And therefore, leveling the playing field is only going to set people that don't have money further back and create a bigger, wider schism between the two. So we have to have more progressive tax laws in place in order for us to be able to bridge that gap so that we don't have this potential, really, for this possible class warfare that's always bubbling underneath the surface in this country.
Mr. Meehl, final thought from you.
Just that I'm hoping and I'm praying that our policymakers and our elected officials find a way to do the right thing. The current proposal that our group has made is really doesn't go anywhere close to as far as it needs to go. It would be a step in the right direction. And out of that, hopefully, will come, we'll put to rest this idea that they're going to hold our country's credit rating and financial stability hostage to what appears to be an ideological agenda. Hopefully, cooler heads will prevail, and we can start to make some consensual progress in this country.
Dennis Meehl is the chair of U.S. Corrugated. He's also a member of a group called the Patriotic Millionaires for Fiscal Strength. They've just signed a letter to President Obama and the Congress asking them to raise their taxes and the taxes of the hundreds of thousands of other Americans who earn more than $1 million a year. He was with us from NPR New York. Andy Shalal was also with us. He's the owner of the Busboys and Poets Restaurant Group and Eatonville here in the Washington, D.C. area. And he was here with us in our Washington, D.C. studio. Thank you both so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
There are problems with NASA's latest mission to Mars, and they may not be enough time to resolve them before the launch date this November. That's the conclusion of a report from NASA's Inspector General. It was released today. The mission involves a rover called Curiosity, and it is the most ambitious Mars project NASA has ever mounted. If Curiosity can't be launched later this year, it will mean a 2-year delay in a mission that is already 2 years late. NPR science correspondent Jill Palka is here to tell us more about this. Joe, first, describe a little about this mission.
Well, as you said, it's a rover, but it's much bigger. The ones that are there now were about the size of a coffee table. This is about the size of a small compact car. Its instruments are designed to not just look for signs of water, but look for places where my life might have actually once been. And they have instruments that can look for certain chemical compounds that scientists think would be found if life had once existed. And the part about the mission that I think is just crazy, wild, fun to look at is how it lands, because it comes roaring in, and it starts off like other missions with a heat shield and then a parachute, but then there's this rocket thing, you know, like the lunar landing, and it hovers off over the surface, and when it finds the right place to land, it lowers the rover down on a tether, like it's holding it up from a crane, and then the tether gets cut and the sky crane flies away. It's hilarious.
I wish our listeners could see you here in the studio describing all of this.
No, it's wonderful. There's a video, I think, you can find on the website. You should watch it. It's great.
We mentioned the report from NASA's Inspector General. Can you tell us a little bit more about the problems that he identified in that report?
Well, the problems were, they identified 10 problems a couple years ago that they said were responsible for the mission being delayed, and 3 of them are still out there, apparently. One has to do with the soil scooper thing that's going to put soil into the instruments, and the other two have to do with software issues, fault tolerance and things like that. NASA, you know, those problems are still being worked on, apparently.
It has to be frustrating for the managers of the mission. What do they say about this report?
Well, the managers are saying, look, we are down to the wire, it's true, but we think we have the margin, and we think we have the time, and talking about this scooper thing, they said, we've figured that one out, it's now fixed since the Inspector General came and talked to us. The Inspector General found like 1,200 trouble tickets that hadn't been resolved. The NASA people say we've resolved most of them and we'll have them all. But it is going to be down to the wire, and they are going to be tweaking the software on this mission all the way until landing. So while it's cruising off to Mars, you know, in the 8.5 months after it launches in November, they're going to be working on the software. Now, that's not unheard of because they did that with the other rovers, too. But it's you know, it's getting there. It's getting to the edge.
But what happens if it misses this window and doesn't launch in November?
Very bad, because it's the way orbital mechanics work. You only get a launch window every 26 months. That's why it was a 2-year delay. That's why if we miss this one, it's another 2-year delay. And so not only is it going to cost more, and the costs have already gone up to $2.5 billion, we're talking about another $500 million and another 2 years waiting.
You mentioned some of the possible resolutions in that Inspector General report. Did he spell out other specific things that can be done?
Well, basically, he says it's going to be, time is time. It's not going to be able to extend it past a few days into December. Money is going to solve the problem. Maybe if they can put some more people on it to fix these problems before the launch date, they'll make it.
Joe, thanks so much.
You bet.
That's NPR's Joe Palca. You're listening to All Things Considered. New York City could lay off thousands of public school teachers this summer, and first to go would be the newest teachers because of seniority protections in the union contract. Beth Furtick of member station WNYC reports on how that's likely to affect one teacher and one principal at a school in Manhattan's Chinatown.
Third grade teacher Chu Hung Harold Lee tapes an index card to every child's desk. It asks the students to state how they're feeling, with three different options ranging from "I am well" to "I need help." These days, if you ask the 26-year-old teacher to pick his own response, he says it would be,
"I'm not feeling my best, or I'm a little confused."
Lee is among 4,100 New York City teachers at risk of losing their jobs this month. The union contract requires the least experienced teachers to be let go first, so elementary teachers with less than 4 years' experience are most at risk. Lee is wrapping up his third year, and it doesn't look good.
I wish that there was more certainty, especially as we move towards the end of the year, because you really want to be thinking about next year. And it seems kind of preposterous that we're just expected to wait.
Lee isn't the only one waiting at PS 124 in Chinatown. The school expects to lose 4 of its 55 full-time teachers if the layoffs go through. Principal Alice Hom says parents and teachers are anxious.
I hope they don't think I'm lying, but I really don't have any information that I can share with them at this time. I've spoken to other principals who are in the same boat, some of them who have, 13 staff members who are supposed to be laid off.
Because the layoffs are based solely on last in, first out, some schools with a lot of new teachers would be especially hard hit.
She stepped into the dark and murk.
In Lee's classroom, his third graders are learning to write realistic stories.
Maybe it's dark and murky. Maybe it's very, maybe it's not even a post office. Maybe
Lee is the son of Korean immigrants who says he wanted to become a teacher because education enabled his parents to become successful. He graduated from Brown University and Teachers College at Columbia. Lee still considers himself a novice, but he says he's learned a lot from veteran teachers. He recalls teaching at his first school in Queens.
I mean, I was just trying to survive, and I was really fortunate that there were a lot of teachers at my old school that were incredibly supportive, willing to share ideas, materials, willing to brainstorm with me.
That's why, despite his own predicament, he wouldn't want to throw out seniority protections completely without a better way of evaluating teachers. The state just created a new evaluation system, but the city and the teachers union are at odds over the details.
In general, policymakers and school leadership, administrative leadership, they're too quick to try to identify, these are the characteristics of a good teacher. And too often it's tied to things that we know aren't the signs of good teachers, like good test scores, for example.
Principal Alice Hom agrees that rating teachers is more of an art than a science. That's why she opposes the law that requires new teachers to be the first ones to go during layoffs, regardless of merit. The union says this protects senior teachers from being eliminated because they make more money. But Hom says a good teacher is worth the cost, and principals should get to make that decision.
There are always other people that you might want to have leave your building for one reason or another. And you have no control over that. You have to deal with, your staff as best as you can.
If the layoffs go through, Hom could replace some of her new teachers with more experienced teachers from other schools. But she says that would be chaotic, and she likes the energy and enthusiasm of her new teachers.
I don't think teachers who are new in the system should necessarily be the first ones to leave because they have some added value.
She says Lee is one such teacher, calling him smart and dedicated.
Hal, if you hear me. Do you think that your comic strip is the only thing you can use when you draft?
Lee envisioned himself teaching for at least 5 years before moving into education administration, but he lost his first job in Queens because of budget cuts. Now that he's at risk of losing his second job in Chinatown, he says he's planning to go to law school unless a deal is struck very soon to avert the layoffs. He applied last year to give himself more options and was accepted at the University of California at Berkeley.
At this point, it's looking more and more like that's the route I'm going to take because I'm not going to wait until July or August to see if I have a job.
His principal says she'll be sorry to lose him. Right now, Mayor Michael Bloomberg and the city council are still negotiating over the budget. Some longtime observers believe the mayor is bluffing because he's made similar threats in the past, but the mayor insists the money just isn't there. For NPR News, I'm Beth Fertig in New York.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Switching gears now. If you're a regular listener to this program, you know that on Fridays we bring you Back Talk. Today, though, we decided it was time for Trash Talk. Now, even if you don't follow basketball, you have to be impressed with the National Basketball Association Championship Finals. The series between the Dallas Mavericks and the Miami Heat is now tied at 2 games each, and each of the last 3 games has come down to the very last shot at the very last second.
James back to Wade. Wade puts it up for the win. Off the mark, and Dallas has tied the finals with one of the most incredible comebacks in NBA Finals history.
Nowitzki spins, head fake, falling away. Shot won't go, and Miami holds on and takes game 3.
Wade lost the ball, goes to the backcourt, gets it to Miller. Miller puts it up. Air ball, and that's it. The Mavericks have evened the series. What a game and what a series.
Now to the trash talk part. One fan of the Mavericks and one fan of the Heat have a particular interest in the outcome of the 7-game series. Representative Eddie Bernice Johnson hails from Dallas. She's with us on the line from there. And Representative Frederica Wilson hails from South Florida. She's with us from there. Welcome to you both. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Michelle.
So I understand that you two have a wager. Can I just get a little bit more details about what exactly you're offering up now, Congresswoman Johnson, if it comes to that? And I know you're not preparing for that. What exactly is going to be on the menu if you should lose the bet?
Well, first of all, we will fly Texas barbecue to Washington. Texas barbecue is not matched by any other barbecue in the nation, or perhaps even in the world. And so that's what I was encouraged to offer by my staff because they, too, enjoy it. However, this might not be an occasion when we'll need it.
Congresswoman Wilson, if it comes to that, what's up with you? What are you going to ante up with?
We ante up stone crabs.
Stone crabs.
Yes, from Miami.
I look forward to that stone crab, too.
Delicious stone crabs. But, however, we're going to leave those stone crabs on ice for now, because I don't think we'll be needing them. We're preparing the table for the barbecue because Eddie Bernice and I are sorority sisters, we're link sisters, and we're friends. But sorry, we will win. The heat is blazing out there in Dallas, and it'll be blazing here in Miami.
Now, Congresswoman Wilson, your team includes 3 of the best players in the league. Now, you know this is true. A very expensive trio, LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh. But you know that there are some who are hating on them. You know this, of course. Does this cause you any anguish at all?
Well, you know, when you're good like that, you get jealous. You know, people become jealous of you. So that's not going to stop them from winning. We've invested a lot of money in them, and they have a great fan base here in Miami. I mean, even they're not playing here. But, you know, the stadium is still full. The arena is full, and people are watching it on big screens. They go in free, and they still pretend that the game is here. So that's not going to be a problem.
So you're brushing off the haters. Okay, Congressman Johnson, what about you? Tell me about brag on your team a little. Why do you think they're going to take it?
Well, first of all, we have a team. We don't have just 3 people. we have a team, and they play well together. When our best player, in many circumstances, Dirk, had the flu last night, and he had a broken finger that he broke back in the first game. But we won. We won because the team rallied. And then the players like each other. Although there are some who stand out, we have a team. And I think that's in the final results of it is going to be the team that wins, not three high players. High-paid players.
Oh, see, so you went there. She went there.
Well, you know what? They're both good teams, but only one great team will win, and that great team is the Miami Heat. So, Eddie, Bernice, get ready to bring the barbecue. He can eat heartily.
All right, well, I'm glad I have you all in two separate cities now.
But the stone crabs would taste very good in this hot weather.
All right, what's the outcome for Game 5? Game 5's coming up.
That's the Heat's game.
Okay, Congressman Johnson, with Game 5's coming up?
Well, now, left up to my good friend, all games are Heat games. But we're going to look in that. We might look out again like we did last night and like we did Thursday night.
Michelle, I rib her all day on the floor, and I have my following, and she has her following. But I have more Heat fans on the floor of Congress than Eddie Bernice has.
So She's right, because there are very few other people in Dallas but me. But we do have some.
All right. Well, good luck to you both. I'm staying out of this one. Congressman Eddie Bernice Johnson is a Democrat. She represents Texas's 30th congressional district based in Dallas. She was nice enough to join us from her home office in Dallas. Congresswoman Frederica Wilson is also a Democrat. She represents Florida's 17th congressional district, and she was nice enough to join us from her home office in Miami, Florida. Representatives, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Michelle.